Local News, Culture, and NPR.
From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition. I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me. Coming up, we'll get the latest news from the Times Union, including an update that fits in with our ongoing coverage of the impacts of the Trump administration that they're having on systems and services at the state and local level. Plus also an update on that fatal Columbia County plane crash over the weekend. And there's been a mistrial in an Orange County murder case. Philip Pantuso joins me in the second half of the program with those updates. We've also got the latest in-state news from our partners at the New York Public News Network. But first, we start with a quick update on the Skinner's Falls Bridge. As reported by Ruby Rayner here on the Local Edition last night, federal judge yesterday issued a ruling that will allow the demolition of the Skinner's Falls Bridge to continue as planned. Judge Caroline Melichick of the U.S. District Court for the Middle District of Pennsylvania sided with the Pennsylvania Department of Transportation, rejecting a legal effort by Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, who were seeking an injunction to spare the bridge from its destruction. In the ruling, the judge cited the bridge's deteriorating condition as a significant public safety threat. Radio Catskill's Tim Bruno spoke to Barbara Arendelle, director of Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, for her reaction.
We tried. We put up a good fight. And even the judge said that if it was just a matter of ruling on the merits, we would have won. But there was the additional factor of PennDOT had three experts testifying that the bridge was essentially falling down while you watch it. And that's really not true. But we couldn't get an expert to testify in this situation. It's very difficult to go up against PennDOT experts. And you know the old story about how if a lawyer has facts, well, they lean on the facts. If a lawyer has laws, then they lean on the laws. And if a lawyer has neither, they bang on the desk. And that's basically what happened.
The PennDOT folks did emphasize the safety risk, as you said, saying the bridge is on the verge of collapse and could endanger lives. They also stated that they explored restoration options, but ultimately concluded the structure couldn't be saved. Do you believe that assessment?
They didn't. No. They have neither the in-house techniques or personnel, nor did they hire anyone who has that knowledge to look at the bridge.
Let's talk about the community. What are you hearing from residents on both sides of the river about this decision and then the ultimate removal of the bridge? Are they feeling this loss deeply?
Yes, very deeply. It's very upsetting. And, you know, the whole thing about mitigation is insane. You know, what PennDOT is saying, well, we'll make the PA pier, the PA abutment, be a viewing platform with a plastic window that shows what it used to look like. What? That's like saying your dear beloved grandma died, so here, you can have a piece of her fingernail. This is insane. It's crazy. It's nuts. Where are people going to park who are going to go there anyway? You know, on people's property? It's just a roadway there. And it's sickening. It's totally sickening. So we want to see something else happen. I mean, we have itemization by Nathan Hoff, who has historicbridge.org website, that PennDOT has destroyed 205 historic bridges in the last 20 years. This will make the 206th. And it doesn't seem like they're going to even entertain the idea of a replacement, but maybe we should push for that.
Excerpts from Barbara Arendelle, Director of Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, reacting to yesterday's ruling on the fate of the Skinner's Falls Bridge. As heard on this morning's edition of Radio Chatskill with Tim Bruno, you can find that full conversation at wjffradio.org. Now for an update on the story that we opened with last night. A grand jury indicted 10 New York State corrections officers yesterday in conjunction with an inmate's death, with two of them charged with second-degree murder. We now have response from the New York State prison officials who are saying they'll review the correctional system's culture. WNYC's Jimmy Vielkind has this report.
It's the second time in less than 2 months that officers were indicted for their role in the beating death of a prisoner. Corrections Commissioner Dan Marticello condemned their behavior.
There's no place for violence in the correctional system, regardless of who perpetrates the crime or the violence inside of our institutions.
Prosecutors say officers beat Masaya Nanchwi last month at the Mid-State Correctional Facility with, quote, fists, batons, and boots. He later died from his injuries. All the officers pleaded not guilty to the charges Wednesday. Their union called the indictment, quote, extremely troubling. In Albany, I'm Jimmy Vielkind for the New York Public News Network.
And Jimmy Vielkind's full article about the indictment is up now at WJFFradio.org. On the main page, just scroll down to the New York Public News Network section at WJFFradio.org. Well, the New York Republican Party is calling for a quick investigation after swastikas were posted on its Albany headquarters this morning. WAMC's Samantha Simmons reports.
A block away from the state capitol, several swastikas with a sign saying, quote, "If this is not what you stand for, prove it," unquote, adorn the door of GOP headquarters. Written on the sidewalk in chalk was "Return Kilmar Now." Kilmar Abrego Garcia is a Salvadoran citizen who was living in Maryland when he was wrongfully deported in March and has not been sent back. In a statement, GOP Chair Ed Cox said the party and democracy are under attack. Cox says the vile act of political hatred is meant to intimidate and silence the party. U.S. House Republican Elise Stefanik, who is exploring a bid for governor, says the vicious criminal who taped the hate symbols to the building shall be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. The Albany Police Department says an investigation is ongoing. For the New York Public News Network, I'm Samantha Simmons.
And finally, to wrap up our New York State headlines, the Trump administration is blocking an offshore wind project in New York from moving forward. New York Public News Network's Capitol reporter Jung Yoon Han has this report.
On Wednesday, U.S. Secretary of the Interior Doug Burgum ordered a halt to Empire Wind 1, which is off the coast of Long Island. The project, which is located about 14 miles from Jones Beach State Park, is slated to begin operating in 2027. It would be the first offshore wind initiative to connect to New York City's grid, and combined with another project, it's expected to provide power to more than 1 million homes. In issuing the order, Burgum made good on a campaign promise from President Donald Trump by attempting to halt operations for offshore wind projects. New York Governor Kathy Hochul decried the order and said it stands to threaten 1,000 union worker jobs. In Albany, I'm Jung Yoon Han for the New York Public News Network.
Thank you, Jung Yoon, and thanks to all of our partners in the New York Public News Network. And believe it or not, we do have more news of the potential impacts of the Trump administration on New York State, including DOGE cuts to cybersecurity, plus the latest on that fatal plane crash in Columbia County, and how a bill designed to limit packaging waste could save New York State nearly $1 billion. All of that when I talk to Philip Pantuso of the Times Union, coming right up after this break. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
It's really ironic. In some ways, Zuckerberg and Trump want the same thing. They want complete free speech on the internet. They want no censorship. He still has to go through this trial because Facebook is still viewed as simply just too big.
I'm Rachel Abrams. That's Today on the Daily from the New York Times.
If it's happening here, it's on Radio Chatskill. Local events, local voices. Live local conversations 5 days a week. Radio Chatskill. Weekday mornings at 10.
Discover how Farm to Shelter Movement is transforming forgotten urban spaces using materials you can feel good about.
These are all principles that are pretty common in farm to table cuisine, and we're using that as a little bit of inspiration.
Plus, Frozen River author Ariel Lahan returns to her off-the-grid childhood home. That's this week on This Old House Radio Hour. Join us for This Old House Radio Hour from APM, American Public Media. Sunday morning at 7 on Radio Catskill.
It's the Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole. And it's time to get the latest news from the Times Union. For that, we talked to Philip Pantuso, Hudson Valley Bureau. I spoke with Philip earlier this afternoon. Philip, welcome back to the Local Edition.
Always good to be with you.
So here on Radio Chatskill, both with you and our other news partners, one of the things we've been following is just the impact of what's happening at the federal level under the new Trump administration, what those impacts are here at the local and state level in New York. And I know you've got an update on some impacts of the DOGE efficiency division.
Yeah, this is news we reported this morning. Our business reporter, Larry Rulison, reported that the Center for Internet Security, which is a nonprofit cybersecurity firm that does work for a bunch of state and local governments, as well as private companies, had its federal funding reduced by more than $8 million by the so-called Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE. And the reason this is a story for us is because not only does the Center for Internet Security do work here in New York, but it's based in an Albany suburb of, called East Greenbush, sort of southeast of Albany. And the type of work it does, one of its main programs helps state and local governments protect their election equipment and infrastructure from cyber attacks. So it's a little ironic, I guess, that that's being cut given all the election integrity stuff that the people in the White House previously seemed to care a lot about. Another one of their main programs helps state and local governments protect infrastructure from outside hackers.
Wow. Is there any, I know this is a new story. Is there any local reaction to this already?
Yeah. So they have more than 500 employees spread out across the country, although their headquarters are in East Greenbush, as I mentioned. They, according to a company spokeswoman, they said they haven't had to make any job reductions at this point, but, you know, they said they can't really fully comment on what these reductions would mean until next week, because they are still sort of, this is news to them. They're still sort of parsing what it will mean. And presumably they're trying to get DOGE to undo this, as it has done with several other cuts in the past. So not a ton of reaction yet at this point, but there will certainly be more news on this next week.
Right. And I know you're also is there a lawsuit in the state that's related to some of these activities?
So this is a federal lawsuit that's coming from a number of labor unions that are seeking to block DOGE from accessing critical systems at the Federal Labor Department. A federal judge yesterday said that he would not dismiss that lawsuit, which the Department of Justice had asked it to do. In the ruling that he issued, he said that the claims that these labor unions had could move forward in court. Those claims are under what's called the Federal Privacy Act, which generally prohibits an agency from disclosing records about a person to another agency unless that person has first given written permission. What the plaintiffs here, the labor unions, are saying is that allowing Elon Musk team at DOGE access to all of this data at the Labor Department would violate, you know, the right to privacy that federal employees have under their Privacy Act.
Right. So we'll see what impact that has and if that changes things on the ground in the state, federal level lawsuit. But as we've seen so far, DOGE has been living up to its very efficient name and moving much more quickly than the courts do. So that's also part of the reality that we've been watching now. So thank you so much for that update. Now,
This is an interesting development for a crime story that we've been talking a lot about over the last couple of years. And this is the trial about the murder of Megan McDonald, which, again, goes back to 2003. Edward Holly was on trial. He was the one who was accused. What's happening with that trial?
Yeah, so the judge yesterday declared a mistrial after the jury said it could not reach a unanimous verdict on what would have been its seventh day of deliberations. So this is a sort of non-end end to a very lengthy and high-profile case that we and a bunch of other local news organizations have been covering. You know, the trial took more than a month, and it wrapped up the week before last. Somewhat stunningly, the defense opted not to present a case or call any witnesses because they felt like, you know, the trial was going pretty well for them. So that was the Friday before last, so almost 2 weeks ago now. Last Monday, all the parties returned to court. They gave closing arguments, and then the jury began its deliberation last Tuesday. And we at the Times Union, and I think a number of other people on both sides, really expected that there would probably be a couple of days of deliberation at most. But as it stretched through the end of last week and into this week, we began to think that there would be, that there was obviously, they were having trouble coming to a unanimous verdict. I believe on Friday, the jury sent out the first of what would become four different notes saying that they were deadlocked and requesting guidance from the judge. She brought them back this week, and they began deliberating again on Monday. And then there were some dramatics in the courtroom on Tuesday, where the jury still could not agree on a verdict. And they let the judge know that. The judge conferred with the prosecution and the defense. Lana Bellamy, who's been in the courtroom every day of this trial and of the deliberations, basically living there for the past 7 weeks, she was able to confirm, based on what the judge had communicated to the attorneys, that they were going to declare a mistrial on Tuesday. And as the judge... which, you know, a mistrial basically is when the jury can't agree. It's the sort of legal term for a hung jury. And as the judge was about to read that into the record, the jury sent out another note making a request for a bit more information. The judge changed what she was going to say and instead brought them back on Wednesday. But Wednesday provided no further resolution. They deliberated for another few hours on Wednesday morning, still could not reach a verdict, and officially the judge declared it a mistrial on Wednesday afternoon. So this case that took 20 years to arrest a suspect, 22 years to come to trial, has still not been concluded. We did find out yesterday afternoon that the judge is going to keep Ed Holly, the defendant, in jail, because at least pending what's called a status conference, which it will be in about 6 weeks, to sort of set the next steps. At this point, the prosecution is intending to retry the case, but it's a little bit complicated in this case because, as listeners may remember, this case is in Orange County. The Orange County District Attorney's Office would typically be the one who would be trying it, but the Orange County District Attorney recused himself because he had previously represented a person of interest in this case. And so special prosecutors have actually been presenting the people's case against Ed Holly. And they've been doing that with money appropriated from the Orange County budget. So it's unclear at this point if the terms of that appropriation would extend to another trial, especially because one can expect that will be, you know, at least another month. of being in the courtroom at least 4 days a week. So,
wow. Yeah, I was going to ask, like, what's going to happen next legally? What are even the options happen legally? But it sounds like there's financial concerns as well as the legal parameters.
Yeah. You know, they might have to appropriate more money. It may be that this is an open-ended thing and that they're appointed until there is a resolution in the case. We're doing some more reporting on that now. There's also the possibility, which Megan McDonald's family has expressed, of bringing a civil lawsuit, like a wrongful death lawsuit, against Edward Holly. And it seems like you can do that you can still do that even though there is an ongoing criminal case as well. Probably the most famous example of this is Nicole Brown Simpson's family bringing a wrongful death civil lawsuit against O.J. Simpson after he was acquitted in the criminal trial. We're doing more reporting on that right now. The family is pretty upset, you know, at the outcome. They firmly believe that Ed Holly is guilty, but it's worth noting that the indictment against Holly that the Orange County grand jury handed up alleges that he did not act alone. So, you know, it's kind of this weird situation where it seems like if Edward Holly was involved in the murder of Megan McDonald, he did not do it alone. But the other likely suspect, who is the person who the Orange County District Attorney represented, he is dead. So yeah, they can't bring a case against him.
Okay. Wow. Well, that is interesting, and it's been a long journey at this point, and it sounds like it's still not over. So we'll look forward to the next round of reporting on this as the next round of developments hit. Now, something had happened in Columbia County over the weekend. You got national headlines. A listener may have heard about this. A plane crash. A deadly plane crash. Now, when a plane crash happens, they get investigated. So is the investigation turning anything up yet?
A little bit. So this was that crash in Kopik that killed 6 people, I think, in total. And on Monday, the National Transportation Safety Board, which leads, you know, the investigations into these transportation disasters, held a news conference where they revealed the weather data. And, the main takeaway from it really was that what's called the ceiling, which is the altitude where cloud cover begins, was at 400 feet at Columbia County Airport, which is where this plane was going to land, a few minutes before the crash. And that's notable because 400 feet is the minimum ceiling for a landing where a pilot must rely on the plane's instruments. At that time, however, the aircraft was about 10 miles away from the airport. And the NTSB member who led this news conference said that it's possible the cloud cover was even lower there. What they also said was that the weather was deteriorating. It was changing pretty rapidly, and that required the air traffic controller at Columbia County Airport to issue what's called a low altitude alert. The pilot of the plane missed his first approach at the airport and requested instructions for another approach. And the air traffic controller wasn't able to get in touch with him to send out this alert about the deteriorating weather, even though we tried 3 times. And that was as, you know, it seems like the plane was probably going down. So, you know, not a ton of new news there, but just kind of filling in some details about the weather situation that seems likely to have contributed to the crash.
Okay, and I know there's going to be a lot more investigating done. What's the time frame for us getting more information about this?
It typically what happens when the NTSB does these investigations is they'll release some preliminary findings, and that can take anywhere between sort of a month to 6 months after the initial incident. And then they'll release their full report, which usually takes about a year, and that will have sort of the fullest explanation that we will get about what exactly happened to cause this plane to crash.
All right. And something that you and I have, we've followed that pattern before with that deadly bus crash. It was a similar thing waiting. You know, that was the process.
Right.
There was a preliminary and then there was like a full report much later. So, well, thank you for that report on that sad news. And now before we go, there is a waste reduction bill. Can you explain what that is, what its implications are, and where is it in the legislative process, which is a loaded question with the legislature. It's still working on a budget in New York and Albany as well. I'll just mention on the side. Yeah.
So this is the Package Reduction and Recycling Infrastructure Act. And it's a state bill that would require companies across the state to cut down on the amount of plastic they use to package their products. The goal with the act would be to reduce plastic packaging in New York by 30%. And, you know, climate advocates are pushing this bill, which I think is just in committee in the Senate right now. But that's because really no bills are moving as they try to wrap up the budget, which is at this point 2.5 weeks late. So there was a new report that came out sort of analyzing what the cost savings of this bill would be if it were to go into effect, and crucial caveat, if the state were to actually make these cuts. As we know from other climate bills, just passing the bill doesn't necessarily mean the state is going to meet those targets.
Right, right.
But this report says basically that if the bill is enacted, it would save local governments about $568 million in terms of that. Mostly cost of hauling plastic packaging to landfills and incinerators and actually dealing with all of it. And it would save nearly $700 million for private waste companies who, you know, are often charged, usually downstream of local governments because they don't have the capacity to process all this plastic. It would save them about $700 million. So combined, the bill would save something like $1.3 billion. It's worth noting that this, you know, was put together by an advocacy group that obviously wants the bill to pass. But certainly, you know, it's undisputed that the cost of processing and disposing of plastic packaging is immense. And, you know, as there are more and more studies that show that stuff ends up kind of everywhere, including in people's bodies. So the more we can try to cut it off at the source, so to speak, certainly there will be huge savings there.
And the people that are, you know, do the report or be kind of advocating for this type of legislation, I'm wondering, are there detractors, opponents to this type of legislation?
So this bill is sponsored in the Senate by State Senator Pete Harkin in the Lower Hudson Valley. It has, he has put it forward in the past, and it's faced opposition from trade groups, including one called the New York Business Council, which basically says that this is going to raise expenses for certain companies just because, you know, actually using plastic is cheaper, and that those expenses, those costs would get passed on to consumers who would shoulder the burden of the mandates placed on the company. So, you know, some vested business interests are pushing against it.
Well, there's at least two sides to every bill, and that goes double for environmental impact bills from what we've seen so far in New York State, as you mentioned earlier. So, Philip, I want to thank you so much for going over all this. I will just remind folks that, of course, these stories are all up now at timesunion.com. We've been talking to Philip Pantuso, managing editor, Hudson Valley at Times Union. Philip, thanks again.
You got it. Take care.
We'll be right back. Well, that's it for the local edition tonight. I'm Jason Dole, and thank you so much for being here with me. Patricio Rabai will be here with you tomorrow night. We'll bring you more news. And we have more news to come tonight before we get into our local music programming. The Daily is next. This is Radio Catskill.